But first to a writer who went in search of her father's very painful past. Belsen, just the name is chilling, isn't it? It sits alongside Auschwitz and Dachau and, well, all the Nazi concentration camps. And when the war ended, the Nazis fled the camps, and the horror of what they'd done to their victims, to Jews, to gypsies, homosexuals and political opponents, was laid bare. Nadia Wheatley is an award-winning Australian writer, and she recently discovered that her own father, a doctor, was working at a camp called Belsen in that period immediately after the war. So what could that possibly mean? She tells her story in the Griffith Review Online in a very richly illustrated essay and beautifully written essay called Mapping the Memories, and Nadia joins us now. Nadia, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Nice to have you here. So this story, this powerful story you've told, began for you with a newspaper clipping. Just tell us about the origins of this.
After my father died in 1983, his widow, my stepmother, sent me a clipping from a newspaper with a somewhat begrudging note saying she'd found it amongst his papers and thought I'd better have it. And when I read it, it was an account of his activities in Germany, in post-war Germany, in 1947, when he became chief medical officer under the occupying British forces in charge of the DPs. But it had a little resume. Displaced persons, yep. Which now has a pejorative aspect, but it was the term used at that time where we would now use the word refugees. So it was people who had been displaced during World War II, and in 1945, when that war ended, there were 12 to 13 million displaced persons in Germany, as well as the Jewish people from concentration camps. There were slave labourers who had been brought in from Poland and from other countries that the Reich had occupied.
So, it's a powerful term, isn't it, when you think about it, displaced? I mean, the world was full of, just awash with people who had been displaced.
Indeed, and they used it differently from the word refugee, which came in a little bit later to mean people fleeing persecution. So that term was used more after the coup in Prague in 1948 for the flood of people, asylum seekers, coming over from the east.
So, now, Nadia, you get this cutting that tells the story about your father.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of man was your father? Because I get the feeling from the way you've written the article that he was quite a difficult man, that your relationship with him wasn't ideal.
Difficulty is a very polite term for it, yes. I didn't actually encounter him until I was about 10 months old. My mother had come back to Australia from Germany to give birth to me, so maybe I didn't bond with him as a baby. But my first memories were of fearing him, and that was my attitude, fear and loathing, throughout my life,
and
throughout my childhood.
And why, Nadia? What did he do that made you so alienated from him?
Oh, dressing up as a Chinese Mandarin in Chinese clothing just to sort of bully and scare me. That was one little episode. So quite nerve-wrackingly acts of minor sadism and bullying,
yeah.
I would describe it.
Cruel. Okay.
Mm.
So your mum and your dad, how did they come to be together? How did they meet?
My mother was an Australian nurse who had served in World War II in Palestine in the Australian Army. And in 1945, before the war in the Pacific ended, she went to Germany to work for UNRWA, which was the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration. Meanwhile, my father, who was a British doctor, had also gone to Germany to work for UNRWA. So after about a year, in 1946, they met up. And their relationship, their love affair began. But they never lived or worked in the same places. They were always in different refugee camps. For my mother, my father was working in medical administration in different towns. And one place he worked, of course, was as superintendent for the displaced persons camp, known as Belsen Displaced Persons Camp, that was established after the horror camp, the concentration camp, was liberated.
Mm. Well, you've always had a very strong sense of place as we say in your own writing, was still a slightly sort of wanky way to talk. You have a strong sense of place, but you know you've written about houses you've lived in. You're a historian in the end. You've got this sense that if you have to walk the land that you're writing about, so this is a quest that calls you. You yourself have to go to Belsen, I guess. What did you hope you would find there by setting off as you've done to this journey to Belsen?
All of my history and also my fiction has to come out of walking a landscape. It has to come out of place. So last September I went to Germany, not just to go to Belsen, but to go to the various places where my parents had lived and worked. And because I had a sort of south to north movement, Belsen happened to be the last place that I came to. I didn't really have any particular expectations. I didn't know what I would find. I hadn't read any secondary source books. And when I arrived at the place, I walked past, initially, the very large documentation centre and walked into the landscape, which your listeners can imagine as a very flat landscape. It's a heath. And at that time, it still had a covering of heather, of pink heath flowers. Belsen Memorial is a site, it's a landscape, it's not just an object or a thing, and indeed it's significant that there are no historic buildings there and no facsimile buildings.
So we're talking about the old concentration camp.
Yes,
now.
The horror camp, the concentration camp. It's a flat landscape, apart from a kind of meditation place, a still house in German, and a inscription wall and a monument. It's a very, very empty landscape with mounds that I describe as being like Neolithic barrows, mounds with unnamed people in them. And in one mound, you might have 5,000 people. In another, you might have 800 people. Because when the British Liberation Forces arrived in April 45, there were 10,000 unburied corpses or recently dead people at the site, as well as some 40,000 living people.
On RN, this is Books and Arts with Michael Cathcart, and my guest this morning is the author Nadia Wheatley. And we're talking about an essay that she's written, an online essay that includes illustrations. And it's worth having a look at this. If you pop along to the Griffith Review, you'll find it there. There's a link on our website. And it's about her search for her father, her father's story, who was a doctor working, it's with the UN, isn't it? It's a UN agency.
Well, yes, it was the first United Nations International Aid Agency. Was there when my father was there, was in charge of the hospital, and I stress, not at the concentration camp, but at the displaced persons camp.
So let's just lay out that geography. So you've arrived at Belsen, and the first place you go is to this place of horror, which is now, as you say, a kind of cleared field with some memorials there, and it's a place, I guess, for reflecting on that horror. Now, nearby is this barracks, this gigantic German barracks, which was being used as a displaced persons camp after the war, and that's where your father was stationed. Now, does that mean that, I mean, I'm assuming that among those displaced persons, there were people who had survived Belsen?
Oh, yes. In fact, it was all Belsen survivors.
Oh, right.
So what happened at the liberation, the reason the liberating forces, the British forces, went in April, that is before the war ended, was because the Germans had actually panicked. The typhus epidemic going on in the concentration camp was at such an extreme level that some German commanders were afraid that it could get out into the German civilian population. So they actually invited the British army to come in. It was made a no-go zone. The British came in, and I don't know if you realise, typhus is spread by lice. And so all the huts, all the people, all the bedding was just redolent with lice. And the only way to stop the epidemic was firstly dust the people with DDT, which now sounds terrifying, but that's what they did, and burn the huts to the ground. So you've got 40-odd thousand people there, many of them very ill and dying, and in fact 13,000 die within the first couple of weeks, and they had to be moved somewhere. 2 kilometres through the woods, there was this vast German army barracks which had been built to house 15,000 Wehrmacht troops. And, of course, most of them had scarpered. And so, fortunately, there was this huge complex of buildings nearby. And so over the process of 4 or 5 weeks, the survivors were ferried by ambulance by the British liberators from the concentration camp site to the new displaced persons camp, which initially was described as the largest hospital in Europe. It had 13,500 people in wards, a lot of which were just outside. At that site, there was also a built hospital, and that was where my father, a little bit later, became superintendent.
Mm. So what are you able to discover? I mean, you walk around, you go on tours, but there's documentation there. You can do actual research?
There's in the documentation centre at the memorial, there is a wonderful archive with very supportive archivist staff. And the archivists help many people like me who come back to Belsen trying to make sense of scraps of family memories. People who come back might be, like me, children of liberators, or, of course, the more significant people who come back are the children of the Holocaust survivors. So that's one part of research I got involved in, but I also did a lot of primary research in the United Nations archives in New York, because that's where the paperwork for the United Nations relief organisations ended up. So a lot of primary research went into this, but after doing the walking the landscape, and I stress that walking the place, going to the place, and indeed I also went to the site of the displaced persons camp, which weirdly is still a British Army barracks. So walking the two sites was the primary bit of the research that I did, and then I filled in the primary source evidence afterwards.
Walking the places that your father had walked. So you are ultimately in search of him, or in search of, aren't you, of whatever it was that made him into that man you remembered as such a bully.
That is a primary bit of my search. I'm actually more interested in my mother. And I guess my question, and many of us would have this about our parents, why did they marry? So why did a nice person like my mother marry someone as difficult and, I would say, ultimately dangerous as my father? That's one question. But of course, as you mentioned, I am a historian. I'm a sort of social and political historian. And for me, my parents' story is simply the beginning of a journey into that fascinating world of post-war occupied Germany. That period from 45 to 1950 has been extremely ignored by historians. It's only now that people are in the English language, are now going into that period. So it's a way, through following two individuals, that I can hopefully map a much bigger story, the story of displaced persons and refugees, which of course has an up-to-the-minute resonance, but also so much of our modern political scene comes out of what happened at that time.
On that more intimate story, the story of why, that question of why your lovely mother married your, you say, almost dangerous father. Did you come to an answer to that? I mean, is he a man who had been transformed, in your view, by the horror that he'd been so intimately connected with?
No, I don't think so. No, I think he was, in a way, an ideal person to work in that place, because he could do a very good administrative job without being involved in personal stories.
Right. So it's a story about a man whose qualities that make him less than ideal in peacetime, at times of war or in the aftermath of war, is able to rise to the challenge surrounded by the insane logic that he finds himself in.
Yes, and indeed, from a lot of primary source material, a lot of documents written by him, correspondence by him, I'm able to build up a picture of a person who was a fantastically good medical administrator, just extremely good at his job. For instance, there were not outbreaks of epidemic and disease amongst the displaced persons population in Germany while he was in charge of them, but there were outbreaks amongst the German civilian population. So he ran a very tight ship as an administrator. But, you know, he ended up running a caravan park on the border of New South Wales and Queensland. I get very annoyed to see someone wasting talent and to, with all this ability, just sort of throw it away.
It's a movie.
It is indeed. Mm.
Well, as we wind up, let's talk about you as an artist, as a writer, because you've really embraced this form that's been made available to you. The Griffith Review now has this online dimension where you can create these, what they call multimedia essays, which is an essay with, well, illustrations, basically, that scroll past. It's a very, very vivid way of working. How did you tackle that? How did you find working in that medium?
Oh, it was a fantastic opportunity for me. I guess I should say that the one of the things that stuck in my mind reading the research is that the first British senior medical officer handling the camps, Lieutenant Colonel James Johnston, when he arrived, could not write, he said, a war diary. The form of the war diary didn't fit what he needed, and so he wrote weekly reports on what was going on. I always believe that form follows function, and to deal with this terribly difficult topic, I needed some new sort of a form. And this one allowed me to work as I do when I'm writing a picture book or when I'm writing illustrated non-fiction, to choose the pictures that say more than the words can do, to pace and place different bits of text, the written text and the visual text, so that the pictures are not just decorations sort of sprinkled like things on top of a cake, but they're an integral part of the text. And of course, the publishing it electronically also meant that I could reach out to an international audience, so that this is an international story, and it needs to be made available beyond the shores of just print journalism in Australia.
Yeah, well, you've always been good at working with pictures. I mean, you've written children's books, very successful children's books, where that's really shone out. So it's worked terribly well, Nadia. Thank you so much for coming on. I thank you for being so generous and candid in the way we've had this discussion.
That's a pleasure, Michael. Nice to talk to you again.
Nadia Wheatley. Her online essay is for the Griffith Review. It's called Belson, Mapping the Memories. And I really recommend this. Do have a look at it. You'll find a link to it online, just at our website, Books and Arts. And Nadia Wheatley is a novelist. She's a biographer. She's a writer of children's books. And like all good historians, Nadia believes in a pair of sturdy boots. This is Books and Arts on RN. Still to come, the new book from Harper Lee. Is it any good? Will the reputation of Atticus Finch as the humanist lawyer survive?